For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. Another Republican lawmaker announces his retirement. Tulsa Senator Dan Newberry says he will be retiring at the end of next January, 1 week before the legislative session begins. Neva, your thoughts on this announcement?
Well, first of all, seven legislators, the number continues to grow. And I think some of that is a byproduct of term limits. I mean, when we see more and more of these folks, particularly these younger legislators who are looking maybe in their last term or maybe with one term to go, they begin to think about what the prospects are for the future. And I think this is what we saw in Dan Newberry's case. So he'd been working for a particular credit union, had an opportunity for great advancement, and decided to take it. 42 years old, four kids at home. I mean, it's one of those, when you step back and look at it, makes sense. But from a legislative standpoint, it continues this ongoing disruption and the ongoing cost of these special elections.
Ryan.
Well, and the ongoing cost of him staying in office. He's saying that he's going to resign, but then he's got an effective resignation date of January. That's problematic. I mean, if you don't want to be in the Senate, I mean, we can debate whether or not he's doing a disservice by creating this enormous cost to taxpayers for the special election, but stop collecting your benefits. Stop collecting your salary. Resign, get out of there, and let's save the state some money. You can, the idea that he has to be there for his executive assistant or an executive assistant to serve constituents in that district during the interim, I think doesn't make a lot of sense. He's maybe holding out if there's a special session that he could come back and serve in that special session, but he hasn't said so. If that's his rationale, he should come clean with that. The group Save Our State, a coalition of organizations that were really pushing for a fiscally sound budget that was responsible to the services that the people of Oklahoma need this year. One of the things that they did at the end of the legislative session is they hosted a Titanic Day at the Capitol, and it was, you know, it's going down and everybody dressed up in Titanic garb. Well, it really is the Titanic with these legislators. Everybody's abandoning ship. I mean, if they could, they'd probably put life rafts around the Capitol. And, you know, I think that Neva's right. Term limits, I left after 6 years. Now I finished my term and gave everybody what they elected me for. But if you're in the legislature right now, you've got 12 years total in the House and the Senate. So right. Or the Senate. So I mean, it's combined 12 years cumulative in the legislature. If you're looking to do something else and you've got an opportunity, it's difficult to walk away, or it's difficult to not walk away
But let's be real. I mean, there are 149 lawmakers. I mean, so even though we're seeing more than usual, I think, in terms of these departures with these early resignations or leaving office for other reasons, we still have the continuity of the overall body. I think the issue with respect to this particular resignation is the fact that there does appear to be a fairly seamless transition. I mean, the governor will have 30 days to set the election. This election will take place, and by the time Dan Newberry leaves office, I mean, we'll have another lawmaker
put the election in until after he actually leaves office.
I think
that was what they were doing with Scott Martin.
Interpretation that I'm hearing is, and I don't know this certainly for a fact, but there has been a discussion in recent days that the effective date of the governor receiving the letter starts the clock ticking on her being able to call the election. So whether they have to wait until January to do that, I mean, I've heard both sides of this argued, and I think that is a question we'll see resolved very quickly.
And I think Neva's right there. The only thing is that the governor can't set the special election in such a way that the new senator would be sworn in at the same time that Newberry's still serving.
Absolutely.
So, you know, Newberry, I mean, that January resignation date's not written in stone somewhere. I mean, he can come back and change that at some point if he needed to. We talk about the election. Lloyd Snow, former superintendent from that district, got, you know, 40% of the vote whenever he ran against Newberry last time around. This is a seat that is one that I think that Democrats may typically have overlooked in the past, but Lloyd Snow is looking at this race again. This is kind of that suburban district where we're seeing some turn towards Democrats. It could be a pickup for Democrats.
Yeah, well, Ned, we'll be able to see it also because whether or not he can come back in. And the only thing that I think most people would worry about is he wouldn't have that January, you know, getting used to getting ready for bills and stuff. If that were to happen, but again, you're right, Ryan, he could change the date at any point, so. Filing ends for two special elections with 17 Oklahomans signing up to be a part of the legislature. Seven Republicans and two Democrats are signing up to replace South Oklahoma City Senator Kyle Loveless, who resigned under an ethics investigation, while six Republicans and two Democrats are vying to replace Representative David Brumbaugh, who died earlier this year. This includes his widow, Shelley Brumbaugh. Ryan, this is an amazingly crowded field.
Well, we were talking about just a moment ago, everybody abandoning ship. These people are buying tickets to the Titanic. So, maybe this is the movie, not the boat. So, I think that,
people still want to be on board.
It's this crowded field. You know, folks want to be a part of this. Both of these seem to be seats that the Republicans are going to hold on to. The primaries can do strange things. We can have a general election matchup that could surprise folks, but both of them hail from Republican strongholds, and so we're probably looking, and especially in these crowded fields, at a primary, likely a runoff, and then those runoffs could very easily decide who's going to serve in the legislature.
Well, the interesting thing when you think about it, I mean, we had two Senate seats, basically South Oklahoma City, Canadian County area. And in the Ralph Shorty seat, we only had one Democrat, one Republican file. Mm-hmm. So went straight to the general election. In this instance, where you have the Kyle Loveless seat that was vacated, last time there was an election, and he did have a primary. But you find that you've got seven Republicans, all with pretty good resumes. I mean, these are folks that jump into the race, but it's a winner-take-all primary, and I think that's the key.
Right. Yeah, okay.
That's the key in both of these races. I mean, they're short-fuse races. Everyone has to be all in, and someone can win by 5 or 10 votes in these crowded fields, and we've seen the competition in some of these earlier special elections where it really is low turnout, and it's all about who can get their folks out to the polls. So it's going to be fascinating in a hot summer when I think there is some voter fatigue out there. Folks are just kind of tired of politics, and certainly with the national backdrop and so much clamor out there all the time, whether someone can kind of break through this crowd and become a dominant candidate quickly, I think that's going to be fascinating in both of these races to watch.
Ryan, this district was 8 years ago, was Congressman Steve Russell and Kyle Loveless went up against each other. There were no Democrats running in that seat. So does it say something that at least you've got two Democrats now in this run?
No,
in this
and I think that when I say that these are leaning Republican, that's just history. That's all that is. And we're at a very different time right now. And Republicans, may have had like a little sigh of relief of, well, the election will take place, the general at least will take place well after the legislative session's over with. So maybe, this budget crisis and the looming, the failed budget, this broken budget that the Republican leadership passed and put in place won't be immediately on folks' mind. But we're looking at a general election that could come really on the heels of a potential Supreme Court decision that invalidates large parts of the revenue measures for the budget, and we could be seeing what a special session, or at least a governor's call for a special session, may look like. So that could become forefront in these voters' minds as they head to the polls for a general election.
And how much does it concern Republicans that you've got South Oklahoma City, two Republican senators have had to resign because of criminal investigations? How concerned were they should they be?
I think, like any election, all politics is local, and mm-hmm. I think it will be incumbent upon all of these folks in the race to make certain that they really are on the doors and really talking and having that direct contact with the voters. I think all of the surrounding issues and elections that are taking place really have less impact on a particular location in terms of what the voters are seeing and hearing and responding to. I think it's a very tough game when you've got a very low turnout and very low interest in these kind of elections.
Yeah, special elections tend not to bring a lot of people to the polls.
Politics local, we're going to see schools in that district with cuts. We're going to see hospitals in that district with cuts on Medicaid. Those are low income districts. So you're going to have folks that are going to have real pain coming out of these state services. Now, whether or not the Democrats can get those folks to the polls is another question.
That'll be the challenge.
But if they show up, these could be competitive.
Governor Fallon signed the third and final corrections reform bill to pass out of the state capitol this year. Fallon expressed disappointment with lawmakers who had up to 12 different bills from her recommendations to reduce the prison population in the state. Neva, we've talked about it a lot and how little this legislature did, but this seems to kind of put an exclamation point on it.
I think it does, and I think it also sets up for a lot more of this conversation to take place in the next session, like we've talked about. I mean, the governor has made this a very significant focus of her last years now in the governor's office, and I think we're going to continue to see a heightened awareness among the not only among the public, but certainly lawmakers, I think, are going to get a lot more feedback in their districts on both sides. I mean, we certainly, this is one of those classic battles where, I mean, we've got defined and organized groups, both proponents and opponents to these pieces of legislation, as well as lawmakers who seem intractable, you know, in some of these areas. And so I think it's just more to continue.
It is the old battle of tough on crime and smart on crime.
Well, and it's a battle that I think the tough on crime crowd knows that they're losing, and they know that, you know, the writing's on the wall. It's just a matter of when. And the governor said this earlier this week. She said, you know, this is going to happen. I mean, she has a lot of confidence that we're going to see these reforms ultimately, more of these reforms ultimately get to her desk, and she's going to sign them into law. The problem is in the meantime, Oklahomans are suffering. There are real families, there are real communities, real neighborhoods where people are suffering because we can't get these reforms passed. And, you know, we're looking at adding $1.9 billion in capital expenditures and operating expenses over the next 10 years. That's why I said I had hoped that the governor, if the legislature didn't put these criminal justice reform bills on her desk, that she would look at any budget that they sent her as irresponsible, because it sets us up for a 10-year deficit. And one that by 2018, we're going to be the nation's leader in incarceration. That's, you know, we've been 1 in 3 men and women, but we're going to take over in 2018. And we just know that from our projected prison growth. This is, again, you know, this falls squarely at the feet of Speaker Charles McCall, who capitulated to Scott Biggs and allowed him to hold these bills hostage. And Neva's right, you know, the people have spoke, State Question 780 and 781, two of the most progressive and important criminal justice reform measures anywhere in the nation, passed by Oklahoma voters the same year they elected Donald Trump. Conservatives, liberals, independents, libertarians, you name it, these folks want criminal justice reform. I think the momentum's there. I would suggest that over the interim, one of the things that we're going to begin to see is not only folks calling their legislators and saying, we want this, but also folks calling their DAs and saying, hey, you need to get out of the way of these reforms. We have DAs like Greg Mashburn, who I think forget, in Cleveland County, that they are held accountable to the voters. We ask him at the ACLU how much money he'd spent prosecuting this glass pipe case down in Norman, and he just very flippantly said he'd spent $114. Well, we know that's a lie. And I think that that's the kind of arrogance that we're seeing. Folks are going to start to reach out to their prosecutors in addition to their legislators.
Neva, I got to ask you, at what point does Governor Fallon maybe pull out Director Joe Albaugh, DOC Director Joe Albaugh, and say, and start pushing his muscle around? Because he feels really strongly about this as well.
Absolutely, and I think we're seeing more of that, not only Director Albaugh, but a lot of folks that can help carry that message. And Ryan is right. When you look at the task force statistics, I mean, if they can continue to get that information out there, they're right. going to continue to get a larger and larger segment of Oklahomans who agree with the need for these changes and for them to be rapid changes. The statistic that you used, Ryan, about the next decade, I mean, adding 7,200, whatever the number is, the projection of additional inmates, we cannot sustain the growth in incarceration that we have, and we certainly cannot tolerate being number one in incarceration for women and men in the next decade. So it's a problem that's not going to go away. Everyone is going to have to figure out a way to get to the table and get smart and tough and right on legislation that gets the job done.
And Biggs has called for an interim study. Sometimes the lawmakers will use interim studies to just kind of prove their own point. They'll stack it up with people who basically say they're the things that they want to hear. How closely are you going to be monitoring what Biggs is doing so to make sure that this is a fair interim study?
Well, this is all theater. I mean, this is, I think, what we're seeing is that Speaker McCall and Representative Biggs recognize that they're on the losing side of history on this deal. And they're trying to have their political cake and eat it, too. They want to stop these criminal justice reforms to satisfy the demands of district attorneys and predominantly, but at the same time look like they're, you know, leading the race towards criminal justice reform. They want to study this issue. This issue's been studied. The results are in, and the results aren't from just the ACLU. They're from the Oklahoma Council of Public Affairs. They're leading conservative groups and liberal groups. Everybody's come together on this. We have studied this ad nauseum. We have solutions that are backed by evidence that we should be putting in law today. So these studies are anything but study. They're just delay tactics.
Well, and you know, it would be interesting if the governor does find herself in a position where she needs to call a special session at some point later this year. Should these be back on the front burner, and should these issues be part of that call and put it full squarely out there where lawmakers, not in a vacuum with hundreds, if not thousands, of other bills and pieces of legislation swirling around, that they have to actually focus on these and make definite decisions and hard votes.
Oklahoma gets a 5-week grace period to its real ID, so Homeland Security consider a longer extension. This means state driver's licenses are still viable in military installations and federal buildings. Ryan, I love coming to you on real ID questions. Your thoughts on this new extension? Because it's one of those things you supported. That you're,
Yeah. So I've changed my mind on this. I voted for Oklahoma. I flip-flopped. And I'll admit it, because I was wrong, and I'm right now. I voted for Oklahoma to become real ID compliant when I was in the legislature. Mm-hmm. I've since realized, what's the trade-off there? We're allowing Oklahomans, or we're forcing Oklahomans into a federal nationwide database system. And when we do that, we're sacrificing some of our individual liberty interest in doing so. Now, you can make the argument that sometimes we do that all the time, but usually there's a trade-off. There's really no trade-off here. There's no demonstration that Real ID is going to make Oklahomans or Americans safer. It's just something that was passed in the wake of 9/11, and now everybody's got to comply. And if you look at the list of non-compliant states, or states that have received extensions, California, New York, just those two among those states, if we know that these extensions are going to keep coming, because as long as you have huge states with huge populations that would entirely disrupt economic, commercial, and government activity across the nation, if they were enforced, the extensions are going to keep coming. So the legislature said, well, we've got to hurry, we've got to do this, and it's an embarrassment. Well, the list of states that we're with there, I think, makes it less of an embarrassment, and I think it makes it inevitable that whether we become compliant or not, which it looks like we're going to, states are still going to get these extensions. There's the enforcement mechanism. The hammer here is really not what it seems.
In the meantime, Neva, they have actually passed, the lawmakers did actually pass a real ID law. So we are kind of headed in that direction anyway.
We are. And I think Ryan's right. We're going to continue, even by the state's own admission, continue to ask for and be granted extensions in this process. But 25 states are compliant. There is a move in the direction for compliance. I think in the majority of the states are moving that direction. Many, like Oklahoma, are just going to have this curve of being able to get it fully implemented. And I think the suggestion that 24 to 30 months is the time frame that they think is realistic in Oklahoma, I think we all know that that's probably ambitious and it's going to take longer. But I think the bottom line is, as we talked about last week, the lawmakers came in early in this session, made a decision on it. I think it largely conforms to what the public would like to see in terms of being able to have a real ID in Oklahoma.
Because there is a choice between you can get the real ID or
that's
if you,
right,
if you
that's
choose
right.
not
and
to.
That, and that was, again, one of those classic, I think, cases of trying to build a compromise, trying to build a scenario where everyone could walk away from the table at least somewhat satisfied with the result.
And now, I bet that that Oklahomans that do get this real ID, that do get the non-compliant ID, they're going to be using that for a very long time, because the enforcement, again, I think just isn't going to be there. And that should tell us a lot about the urgency of this. If the federal government really saw real ID compliance as this huge hole in our security for the nation, you know, the enforcement mechanism would be much more aggressive than it is. And that what it says is that our intelligence agencies, our federal law enforcement agencies, they've looked at this and they said, you know, this is really just fluff. And if we get it, great, but if we don't, let's not shut down JFK or shut down federal buildings or military installations from public access just because of this.
Yeah, LAX is doing improvements. They can't actually, you know, if they said, no, we can't have an ID, that'd be interesting.
It would.
The Oklahoma Department of Transportation is recalculating its 8-year plan after lawmakers cut more than $150 million from the program. Neva, while some projects are getting extended a year, this doesn't appear to be impacting current projects.
It doesn't, and I think when you look at that 8-year plan, we're talking 1,600 projects that are in this overall plan. So I think ODOT, like all agencies, are having to make these ongoing adjustments year after year based upon the budgetary considerations. But frankly, when you look at it, I mean, I think they would have to have a sigh of relief and basically say we came out fairly well in a very bad budget year to be able to move forward and not have to scuttle or make significant dramatic changes to the overall planning.
Ryan.
It's delayed pain. We walked out of this session, and Director Patterson has said, you know, we're at a spot where we're going to be able to continue current projects. Ongoing projects aren't going to be interrupted. But that 8-year plan is, you know, historically incredibly important to the state's infrastructure. And we've used that to reduce the number of deficient bridges. That's part of that 8-year plan, and we wouldn't be there today if we weren't able to complete those projects. And so what we're seeing now is that bridges that aren't deficient today but may be deficient 4 years from now that are on that 8-year plan, that could be punted off at some point. And the budget picture probably isn't going to be any better whether we come out of this special session. I'm talking about it like it's inevitable. I think it's inevitable that we'll either have a call for a special session and the legislature will ignore it, or they'll come back into special session. But there'll probably be further cuts because it's unlikely they'll get new revenue there. Going into an election year next year, the revenue raising measures that were hotly debated this year will be even more difficult to pass because of the election year mm-hmm. dynamics. And so I think ODOT, they see that right now they may have walked out of here. They dodged a bullet this year, but they see it coming next year.
But they do have an opportunity through bonding and other mechanisms to be able to have probably more flexibility and more discussion among the legislature than many of these other large agencies. So I don't see the appetite among lawmakers to make significant cuts to the transportation planning and to keep things moving forward. So I think while there have to be some budget tightening here and there and some adjustments, I don't think they're major at this point. And I certainly have heard no conversation that it would indicate that that's going to be something that's kind of big time on the chopping block in the future.
And Republicans early on, when they took over the House and Senate, fought hard to get this money, the top money for the 8-year plan to put this together after what they say was Democrats not funding
transportation. And I think this has been a bipartisan, largely bipartisan sentiment that transportation infrastructure is critical to long-term success for the economy, for Oklahomans in general. And so I think that they will continue to make sure that they move in that direction. Will ODOT always get every dollar it wants and be able to fund every project it wants on exactly the timeline it wants? Maybe not. But I think in the big picture, it's still very bright for transportation in Oklahoma.
Just 2 points. I think that, you know, Neva's absolutely right. They've got the bonding flexibility. The legislature needs to give them that. And then we've seen that off-the-top money rated for the last couple of years to go into general revenue. So I think that, you know, they have that flexibility, but the legislature still has to have the willingness to step up. Second point is that maybe with less money, ODOT will do the one thing that I want them to stop doing, and that's mowing down the wildflowers in the median. So maybe if they don't have the money to do that, they'll let these wildflowers
go
instead of mowing them to look like fairways and with litter-strewn fairways.
Now we know the important issue
the
of the day for
yeah.
Ryan.
The wildflowers may be the only beneficiary of this year's budget.
Unless you have to deal with allergies, then there's a problem. Fantastic, guys. Ryan and Neva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.